You're on the Front Porch. This week, Governor Jim Justice's proposal to the Trump administration to subsidize Eastern coal production. He says it's a national security issue. We'll debate that. Also, we will talk about the disaster in Texas. We're no stranger to flooding here in West Virginia and Appalachia, but how should we pay for these disasters? And also, is it hypocritical for politicians to ask for funding for their disaster, but oppose it for others? Support for the Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather. Download it at Google Play or iTunes. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I am joined by our liberal co-host, Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And Lori Lynn, conservative columnist and lawyer. Hey, Lori.
Hey, Scott.
And we're going to talk about Governor Jim Justice's proposal to subsidize Eastern coal. He proposed to President Trump and the Trump administration a $15 a ton subsidy for Eastern coal. And the purpose was national security. He says if there's some sort of attack, the fact that we increasingly are getting our power from either renewables, natural gas, or Western coal puts the Eastern seaboard at risk.
$4.5 billion a year. It's just an absolute fraction of the price to pay for security, for protection.
We talked to an expert on this. His name is Jason Bordoff. He directs the Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy, and he was also a member of the National Security Council during the Obama administration.
This seems like a rather transparent effort to subsidize an industry that has been in structural decline for not only years, but decades. While concerns about fuel supply reliability are legitimate, picking winners by subsidizing the production in the name of national security of one fuel that is declining because of all these market forces and has a lot of environmental externalities associated with it is not a smart or cost-effective solution.
I mean, I think he raised some really valid points. And, you know, there's this thing, a mantra you hear a lot, government shouldn't pick winners and losers in the marketplace, although in reality, government's done that all along. But even the Trump people didn't go for this, right?
Well, they haven't approved it yet. There was a separate issue with Bob Murray, the head of Murray Energy, who owns a whole bunch of coal mines, especially in northern West Virginia. His company made a request to the federal government, similar but kind of more amped up request, to declare the shutting down of coal-fired power plants a national emergency and to stop it, to have a moratorium on it. That, so far, has been rejected by the Trump administration. It seems like they're not going to do that, at least not right now. This larger issue of the subsidy, I think it's still on the table. Lori, what do you think?
Okay, so let's stipulate that these are sort of bad ideas, particularly the Murray thing, forbidding plants to stop burning coal, is silly. But I'm kind of uninterested in hearing about how hypocritical that is or how Soviet that is or, you know, how crazy it would be for the government to tell power plants what fuel to burn when that, in fact, was exactly the project of President Obama's Clean Power Plan was to tell them they couldn't burn coal. So I would like to say maybe the government just shouldn't be telling power plants what fuel they should burn. I mean, you know, we talk about picking winners and losers. I think it's a silly phrase. It's a silly phrase to use. It's a silly phrase to attack. The government has been picking winners for years. Renewable energy gets huge billion-dollar subsidies. They get, in fact, as of last year, 59% of the country's energy subsidies go to things like wind and solar. 25% go to fossil fuels. So you set up this system that is not the free market. Far from it. And then you call coal companies hypocritical for wanting to get in on that action, the same action that renewable companies have been in for years. You know, sure, fine, they're hypocrites too, but you don't have a lot of standing to call other people hypocrites.
Why don't we just stipulate that everybody's hypocritical when it comes to their livelihood?
Except someone, for example, like Rand Paul, the Cato Institute, the Reason Foundation, that say, hey, maybe we shouldn't subsidize any of this stuff.
Well, let's think of it this way. The federal government has an interest in certain things. For example, national security. Governor Justice, he's not saying subsidize Eastern coal because we want to save our miners, although that's part of it. The thing he's pegging this on is save our miners in the East because someday you're going to need them if we're ever attacked. and you're going to be sorry because all of a sudden the power grid will go down in the Eastern Seaboard. So that's a legitimate interest. Now, whether that's true or not, that's where we bring in the experts to debate this.
Yeah, I hope people are thinking about things like that. Jim Justice probably isn't the right person to be opining on it, but I do hope that we have people at our Department of Energy, for example. And, you know, you do constantly hear, like, what if X event happened? What would our power grid, how would our power grid react? You know, things like that. So, yeah, I do think those things are legitimate things to worry about. But I think here that's clearly somewhat of a pretext.
Every expert that I've read, seen, that we've talked to doesn't think that that's really the issue here yet. There's not proof of it, at least. And when it comes to renewable energy, the government also has an interest in reducing pollution. I have a right to breathe clean air, and individuals can't force that to happen. It has to be a government action to make sure that the air is breathable. So basically, I think what you're talking about is competing interests. What's more important to you? And when you have a different administration, you have different interests come to the fore.
Also, this is a good time to think about the concept of rent seeking, trying to get the government to subsidize your industry.
Well, I think one of the classic examples of this, and I think this is something that left and right now agree on, is, Scott, you're from Iowa, the corn-based ethanol subsidy, which, you know, even environmentalists now think that that is actually not the best use of corn to put it into our gas tanks. But things like that are really, really difficult to get rid of. You have this problem where it benefits a small number of people. It benefits them a whole lot. There's the additional layer of complication that Iowa is the first in the nation primary. And so you have all these presidential contenders going out there, falling all over themselves to praise ethanol.
Can I make an argument, a good faith argument for subsidizing Eastern coal? The market is wild. There's this thing called creative destruction, destroying old industries, and new ones are rising up to take their place. Of course, who doesn't benefit sometimes are people in rural, isolated areas who depend heavily on one industry that goes boom and bust all the time. Why can't the government use its power to soften these highs and lows, to even out the booms and busts, to wean us off of our economic dependence on coal as a region? Instead of huge variations that destroy families, lead to huge addiction problems, you know, why not use the levers of government to kind of like smooth out the edges?
I couldn't agree more. In fact, there are probably more direct ways of actually doing that than subsidizing coal companies. There are more direct ways of helping coal communities. And
yeah, but people see that as charity, Rick, instead of as economic, you know, development.
Well, government subsidies to corporations are kind of charitable, too, the whole rent-seeking thing. It's like Adam Smith said, people of the same trade seldom meet together even for merriment or diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or some contrivance to raise prices. Well, that's from the communist tract, The Wealth of Nations, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just made the argument for the government subsidizing wagon makers when the horseless carriage was invented. And you can make the argument that it's, you know, for a few years. The problem is, like I just said, these programs get entrenched and entrenched and entrenched. I sympathize with the desire to have a softer landing and to not have these abrupt convulsions where, you know, a mine closes down, 1,000 people are out of work overnight. But in the end, you know, you just, I think, postpone the pain and you end up with these programs that kind of go on and on and on and don't actually really in the big picture help people.
Well, let's finish out with a conversation about national security. The steel industry is another one that Trump has talked about. You know, the American steel industry is just a fraction of its former size. If there is another World War III type war, we would not have the capacity right away to be able to build the planes and the tanks and all the material we would need. Rare earth is another one. China produces the vast majority of rare earth elements that we need in order to make things like iPhones and computers, which, by the way, there's an effort here in West Virginia to start producing these rare earth elements here.
I mean, I think looking at different contingencies for the future is never a bad thing. But the thing is, I don't think we can ever completely predict it. And the country's been really good at amping up to meet needs before, given the political will. And we have a history here in this country of turning on a dime. It's just a question of what the priorities are. Going back to the wagon makers, I mean, I have an idea for a really snarky bumper sticker, which is whale oil kept the lights on, which it really did up until about the Civil War, you know. And I think the thing that, to quote, was it Garrett Ballingy we've had on here? You know, one thing I agree with him
Garrett,
on it.
Garrett Ballingy from the West Virginia Cardinal Institute.
Yeah, that if we're going to invest, let's invest in the kind of things that would make the economy likely to kick off.
One last thing. I do think that there's an issue of mind space. And if we're spending all of this energy and time trying to protect and promote the coal industry, are we really spending the energy and time we need on other industries that might, just might be a path forward for more growth? One example, Chelsea Ruby, the head of the West Virginia Division of Tourism, was at the business summit talking about the fact that West Virginia, get this guys, of all the states surrounding West Virginia has the smallest amount of tourism spending, the fewest number of visitors, the fewest number of employees by far.
Fewer than Kentucky, really?
Yes, wow. Half of Kentucky.
That's amazing.
It was shocking to me because what it says to me is that that is a huge untapped resource for us.
What does Kentucky have going for it that we don't? Really?
Bourbon, horses, mammoth caves.
Horses.
And
yeah,
advertising. I mean, part of it is you can have the best, and I think we do in West Virginia, really, some of the best landscapes, some of the greatest times. But if nobody knows about it, and this is a fact, our tourism budget, advertising-wise, is just minuscule compared to other states. Nobody knows about it. They're not going to come. There was one estimate that this thing would cost like $4 billion, this coal subsidy. Wow, what could we do if we spent $4 billion building up and promoting the tourism industry here? And would that be more sustainable in the long run? So just something to think about.
We're coming after you, Kentucky.
Okay, that's right. And we have moonshine.
Watch your back.
Which is more efficient than bourbon.
It is, way more.
Hey, Rick, you were too young to be involved in the whole Vietnam War thing, right?
I remember it. I mean,
growing up, you mean?
Yeah.
Did you have relatives, friends, people, neighbors that were veterans?
Yeah, I wore a POW bracelet for a guy from Milton who never came back. It was Marshall Pauley, I think was his name. And it's like my brother's generation.
My dad was a Vietnam vet. He was in the Navy. And he started out in these ships that were patrolling the waters outside of Vietnam, but then eventually got transferred into one of those PT boats you hear about that was going up and down the river deltas. And until very shortly before he died, he never talked about it ever with anyone. A lot of these guys, they came home and they quietly just went on with their lives, never really dealt with what they saw, and never really were thanked properly for what they did. And so I'm really proud to tell you that West Virginia Public Broadcasting is trying to do its part to document their stories and to thank them by doing a documentary called Vietnam West Virginians Remember. And we're doing a series of these events throughout the state to show the documentary and to thank veterans. So if you're interested, go to our website, wvpublic.org, and see how you can watch and maybe come to one of these events, take part, and thank folks like my dad who did their part during Vietnam. Thanks. Okay, we're back. Let's start with disaster relief. You know, the disaster in Texas is huge, but of course we've had some pretty big floods in West Virginia, including the one last year. And how should the federal government pay for these things? In other words, should we borrow money from China to pay for disaster relief for people that are in these areas? Or should we, as some conservatives have suggested, should we reduce spending in other areas to be able to pay for disaster relief?
Oh, we're borrowing money from China for everything else. So if we're spending money on it, we're borrowing money from China. So the borrowing isn't really the question. I think what people like Ted Cruz, the Texas senator, for example, has been singled out. He objected during the Superstorm Sandy. The disaster relief bill in that case was somewhere between 50% and 60% actual disaster relief. And the rest of that money was just larded up other stuff that people stuck into that particular appropriations bill because it wasn't subject to offsets. And so he objected to that. To the extent that he was objecting to that, that is completely legitimate in my book. Larding up disaster relief bills with things in California and Montana that have nothing to do with the actual disaster, surely we can all agree that that's kind of silly.
Stop calling me Shirley, Lori.
I've heard that referred to as like a Christmas tree bill. In other words, you start with the tree, which is disaster relief for, say, Sandy or Harvey, and all of a sudden people are hanging all these ornaments like relief for coal country.
Do you remember last year or a couple of years ago in the legislature, there was this insane Christmas tree bill that was like indoor smoking at casinos, tobacco tax, maybe Christmas seals for porcupines. I don't know. It's all this weird stuff.
And they do that because procedural rules make this bill not subject to limitations that other bills would have. And also, it's very difficult politically for people not to vote for it.
You know, and it's interesting. Disasters are different. They need fast response. But that also is a recipe for misuse of money. When I was a reporter at the Charleston Gazette Mail, we did a whole series of stories about a guy called Philip Porkchop Booth, who benefited from the floods in McDowell and Wyoming County by selling overpriced furniture that was bought on an emergency contract.
My first thought is that I'm fascinated with the idea of inserting food items between first and last name, something like Scott Ramen Noodle Finn. I just have to get that out. Sorry.
I would not be Scott Ramen Noodle Finn. I would be Scott Hot Fudge Sunday Finn or Scott Corn Cob Finn, you know, lots of things. You would be Rick. You would probably be Rick Ramen Noodle Wilson.
Oh, Rick Cornbread. I'm okay with cornbread.
Oh, Rick Cornbread Wilson.
You got it.
I would definitely be mac and cheese. No question. Laurie Mac and Cheese Lynn.
But we digress. I do think a lot of times in many areas of life, we feel like we have to do something right now when we're usually that is not the case. And when you feel like you're under extreme pressure, you don't see all the options that are there. We talked about that before. And so finding out, trying to get good intelligence on the ground about where are the optimal points of intervention, you know, who's actually good at what they do and things like that.
Right. What we have to do right now is pluck these people out of water and get them to dry land, get them safe, get them fed, get them clothed. But you're right, when, you know, millions of dollars pour in for disaster relief, that's really more of a long-term project. And you're 100% right. There's been a lot of talk on social media about, you know, don't give to the Red Cross, don't give to this, don't give to that. It's kind of hard to cut through the clutter and think, you know, what should I do? What is, you know, given that I don't have a little fishing boat that I can go down to Houston and rescue people in, what's the best way to actually help people? And a lot of that is long-term help.
And can we talk about those little fishing boats? Because that's been one of the real bright spots of this whole disaster is the Cajun Navy, the people who are helping their neighbors. And you know, I was interested to hear an interview with Craig Fugate, who's the former head of FEMA. He's the guy that turned it around after the whole Katrina disaster and lack of response. And what he said is the first responders don't come right away to rescue people, that they're not always available. And the truth of the matter is, with a disaster like this affecting, you know, 6 million plus people in the Houston area, there are not enough of those traditional full-time first responders. And it is actually built into these emergency plans that neighbors are supposed to help neighbors. They count on that. And they actually try to encourage it, and they try to plug these volunteers into their systems. And so the next time there's a flood in your community, and let's say you're one of the lucky ones that is not affected, part of what they're counting on is that you don't just say, phew, and then take some pictures and post them to Facebook. They want you to get involved. It reminds me when Richwood flooded in 2016, it was neighbors of the nursing home that went into the nursing home and floated out on mattresses, a lot of the incapacitated people, saving their lives. So anyway, I just find it fascinating that neighbors are the first responders in these things. And you need to have that in your head when there's a natural disaster.
Well, it has also a lot of implications. We've talked on here before about communities where you don't know your neighbors. And, you know, it's just kind of you and your little house, and there isn't a whole lot of community contact. I don't think West Virginia really has that problem. But if you think about a place like that where you don't know the guy next door, you know, are you going to go check on him? You don't even know his name. You don't know who lives there. So part of it is having the kind of community in the first place where people know each other and are more likely to reach out and help.
The other thing that I think that's striking similarity between the Gulf Coast and here is the prevalence of chemical plants. And we're seeing that now with some of the explosions going on with a chemical plant who was overwhelmed with the flooding, and the electricity stopped and their backup generators stopped. And therefore, the chemicals have this chain reaction and they're burning and exploding. Questions need to be asked constantly. I know we have a really good chemical safety disaster response group here in the Kanawha Valley of West Virginia. And yet we should say, wait a second, I know that there's a plan for when there's a flood. But is that plan, you know, does that work when there's a 500-year flood?
Also, the times those 500-year things don't really work anymore.
That's exactly right, right? I mean, we can't assume that these things will never happen. And so I hope that people in the valley and these chemical plants in particular are looking at this and saying, wait a second, what happens if the unthinkable happens? What happens if Bluefield Dam is broached and the Kanawha River floods and
I've
over
heard
its bank?
24 hours was how long it would take to really reach Charleston. and it would flood the first floor of the Capitol. Have you heard that? Is that
this is a Bluefield Dam?
Bluestone Dam, yeah.
Okay. No, thank you. Yeah, the Bluestone Dam was breached. Yeah. All of a sudden, for the first time since these things were built, the flats of Charleston would flood. And what does that mean? That's hundreds, 100,000 people easily affected, more than that. Rick, do you have any final thoughts, last words?
Apropos of Houston, there's Bob Marley lyric, "When the rain falls, it don't fall on one man's house."
So you're giving me the bumper music, essentially.
Well, also Bob Dylan's High Water. Got to close on that. Yeah, Dylan is a prophet.
Two very different artists.
Yeah, Dylan is more like a Hebrew prophet, and Marley's more Rastafarian,
Well, Marley is Rastafarian.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, cool. All right, we'll go out on that. That's Rick Wilson, liberal columnist and employee of the American Friends Service Committee. And, of course, we heard from Lori Lynn, conservative columnist, lawyer. Thank you both for joining me. Really appreciate it. I'm Scott Finn with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening.
High water rising, rising night and day. All the gold and silver I've been storing away. Victor Turner looking east and west from the dark room of his mind. He major Kansas City, 12th Street and Vine. Nothing standing there. I want to hear it with. Shacks are sliding down. Folks lose their possessions. Their folks are leaving town. Bertha Mason shook it, broke it, and she hung it on the wall. Say you're dancing with whom? They tell you to, or you don't dance at all.